Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Freeforum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'll be speaking today with Charles Eisenstein, author most recently of Climate, A New Story. To learn more, go to charleseisenstein.org. And Eisenstein is E-I-S-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing new interviews about every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. Quick plug for participation. Ever since Trump's election, I've been giving out these websites if people want to stay informed and get involved. And the most comprehensive one I find is Indivisible. And the website is indivisibleguide.com. And they have at least 5,000 local chapters around the country, and they send out a weekly thing telling you what's going on, where to maybe make phone calls, send petitions, that sort of thing. OurRevolution.com grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And then two that were primarily digital, but have over the last few years become much more coordinated with grassroots action nationally. That's MoveOn.org. MoveOn1word.org, and for the state of California, CourageCampaign.org. Okay, so that's just get involved, stay involved, be part of the citizen action in this country. Now, to today's guest, when you ask someone why they first became an environmentalist or got involved in environmental issues, they're likely to point to the river they played in or the ocean they visited or the wild animals they observed or trees they climbed in when they were a kid. They're a lot less likely to mention the Clean Air Act or cap and trade legislation. Today's guest uses that fact as a jumping off point to make the case for a wholesale reimagining of the framing, the tactics, and the goals that we employ in our journey to reverse climate change and heal from ecological destruction. If we begin from an understanding that the rivers, the forests, the creatures of the natural and material world are sacred and valuable in their own right, not simply for carbon credits or preventing the extinction of one species versus another, we can awaken the possibility of engaging meaningful emotional and psychological connections that are bigger and deeper than any policy solution or practice might ever be. Now, one of the things we talk about a lot on this show, and have been doing so for a long time, is the need for new stories, new narratives. Heightened with the 2016 election, we must generate a vision, I believe, of the future that it is as compelling, inviting, and real as the past some so fondly remember. So what is a compelling narrative that can drive Americans to yearn for a future richer than the past so many seem to want back? What vision can we offer to engage their emotions by fueling their yearning rather than feeding their fear? And I suspect that that vision, as it was in 1960, is as American as the Mayflower or the Conestoga wagon and the Apollo spacecraft. We need to call Americans to embark together once again toward a new frontier. Okay, a new frontier that confronts big problems with new innovative solutions. When people ask me what I envision when I talk about a world that just might work, which is one of the titles of this show, it's what I base most of my work on, that slogan or motto, if you will, one of the primary pieces, I feel, is a new worldview. The old worldview, reality is dead, static, and separate. New worldview, reality is alive, dynamic, and interdependent. And I find resonance with those notions in the writing and the thinking of today's guest, Charles Eisenstein. He focuses on themes of civilization, consciousness, money, human cultural evolution. After graduating from Yale with a degree in mathematics and philosophy, he spent the next 10 years as a Chinese-English translator in Taiwan. He hosts the podcast A New and Ancient Story and is the author of at least four books, The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, and his latest, Climate, A New Story. Welcome, Charles Eisenstein, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Oh, thank you, Terrence. Really happy to be here.
Okay, and let me tell listeners that we're recording this conversation Wednesday, February 28th, 2019. So, Charles, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you tell us in your own words a bit about how you see your path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. And feel free to take a little bit of time with this. And let me note that on your website, when I looked for a bio, I found instead basically the answer to the question that I just asked.
Yeah. I never was too fond of bios, you know, because that's the sanitized version of who you are. And it's kind of a dilemma. What do I say to people who I don't know? That am I supposed to expose my most tender vulnerabilities? That doesn't feel quite right either. But I can definitely say that the work that I do today came from a feeling that there was something deeply wrong with the world that had been offered to me as normal. And I think that this is certainly not unique to myself. In fact, I think in my generation, I guess I would call myself Generation X. Mm-hmm. In my generation, there was this ambient feeling of wrongness or betrayal that brought so many of us to become slackers. Like, we invented the word slacker. some of us became addicted to things, or we just kind of half-heartedly participated. We just half-heartedly participated in a world that was offered to us, and there didn't seem to be any alternative. And so, but I couldn't let go of the feeling it's not supposed to be this way. It's supposed to be more authentic. It's supposed to be more beautiful. There's not supposed to be starving children. Like, this can't be right. We can't accept this. And that made me unwilling to fully participate. So even though, like, you know, I went to Yale and so on, my heart was never in it, and I basically jumped ship right after college. And as you said in the bio, you know, I went to Taiwan, and this imperative seized me to find what is the origin of this wrongness. Is it just me? You know, am I just maladapted and don't have my acts together? And you need to exercise more discipline to become a productive member of society? Or is the problem not in me? Is the problem in the world? And so this was, and like you were saying, like these moments of environmental awakening were definitely part of that, to see beauty being destroyed. That also contributed, and to read about it. My father gave me radical books when I was a teenager. I read Wendell Berry. I read Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. So all of these things contributed to this quest to discover the origin of the wrongness in the world, in me. What's going on here?
Okay. And you after the dropping out, if you will, and the time in Taiwan, with these questions always, I guess, gnawing at you, what came next?
Well, eventually, so in Taiwan, I really had a powerful awakening because I was immersed in a culture and a worldview that was radically different from what I'd grown up in. And for example, I encountered phenomena that my Yale education told me couldn't possibly exist. It couldn't be real. Yet there I was experiencing it. So I began to question, what else have I been told that is real, that may not be real? What else have I been told about what is possible that might be just a narrow part of the bandwidth of real possibility? What have I been told about who I am that may not be true? So I began to question everything, and that led me eventually to... So eventually I moved back to the United States and settled in basically suburbia and to be near my parents to mm-hmm. raise children. You know, we started having a family. And man, it wasn't like it was when I was a kid. You know, there weren't gangs of kids playing outside, riding bikes, playing sports. Everybody was shut up in their own box. And I was like, what is happening here? And it led me to realize that this separation from each other and this dissolving of community, and none of the neighbors knew each other, that this was part of the same phenomenon as our separation from nature, as the othering and dehumanization of other people that takes the form of racism. Like all of these things affecting every institution, especially the money system, all of these things are the playing out of the same story of separation that is grounded at a very basic level in Newtonian, Darwinian worldviews that who you are is a separate self in an objective world of other. So our basic metaphysics has separation built into it, and it, I'm not, I hope this isn't like getting too philosophical, but it infiltrates all of our social and political and economic systems as well as our own psychology. And that if, and so this is what comes up in the climate book, that if we see the world as essentially a geomechanical machine, basically if we see it as a dead thing, as a bunch of random biochemistry, for example, to be used for our instrumental ends, we see it that way, it's going to become that. If we hold a story of the world as dead, it begins to die. And it has been dying and dying and dying. So that's part of the importance of story, which I'm really happy to hear that you're hammering away on that too, the importance of narrative. Mm-hmm. The story that we hold about ourselves and other people and the world is an invitation for it to be that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, and then at that point you begin to write, so I believe. And so what I want to ask you actually also, is can you trace sort of the evolution of your thinking and your perspective through the four books I mentioned?
Yeah. Okay. So The Ascent of Humanity, that was the first one. And that was this gigantic 600-page meta-historical narrative where I really painted the this perception of separation that I had. I kind of crystallized that. What exactly is this mythology of separation, tracing its scientific origins, how it plays out in our medical system, educational system, economic system, how all of our institutions, religion, science even, are built on that story, and how it gives birth to the crises that transition us out of that story. So it carries the seeds of its own dissolution or its own transcendence. And then what might a new story give birth to? What would a story of reunion or interbeing generate as far as economics, medicine, education? Like, what would the world look like if it were built on a different story?
Mm-hmm.
So that was that book. And then I wrote Sacred Economics, which applied these ideas more specifically to economics, to money, capitalism. It's not anti-capitalist, but it's more saying what capitalism is and has been depends on what capital is. And capital is a set of social agreements and stories. Like, ownership isn't real, except that we make it real through our agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So what would it look like with different agreements? And so I went into a lot of nuts and bolts economics also in there, and also really explored what community is, how community is woven from gifts, and why it's dissolving. And then I wrote this during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. So I addressed that a lot. And and what would a system look like that, again, embodied a different story. And then, so let's see, after that I wrote The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, which is a much shorter book and kind of a distillation of the ideas of a transition in our deep stories, or our myths, you could even say, and with a special attention to the personal level. Like, what is it like for us as individuals to be going through a transition out of our old story through a space between stories? Because our stories, they tell us who we are. You know, they tell us what's real, what's important, how to live life. And these stories are breaking down on so many levels. So casting people into this in-between zone where it's like, gosh, I don't even know who I am anymore. I don't know what's real anymore because this breakdown happened. And there's this longing. And I think this is what is in part behind the Trump phenomenon, this longing to have a story that tells us how to live life, who you are. And so people grasp for maybe a fascistic story or a racist story or some story that at least tells you, okay, here's who you are, here's how it is. And so that book, a lot of it is maybe a call to embrace the uncertainty and the unknowing and the breakdown. And so as to be able to recognize the next story that wants to happen as part of a healed world. I've been talking a long time now.
Since the book remaining is the book we're going to talk most about, that's okay. But I think for someone whom you and your work is new to, I wanted to give them a sense of how your thinking has evolved in your writing. And what I can see is the first one is, you know, you'd been curious, passionate, so on for years. And the first one is kind of the big, you know, it's everything up to then. It's like often I think of musicians whose first album is, you know, the best music they've come up with for their whole life. The second album is often, wait, what do we do now? But it sounds like what you did on the second one was the Sacred Economics was take it from, oh, here's the big everything, to let's look at money. And the third one is let's look at your own personal life. And then finally this one says, let's look at climate. All, it seems to me, filtered sort of through that perspective that, as I said at the top, is very much, I mean, that's one thing that I saw was that this thing about old reality, old story, new story. I certainly, share very much of what you said in terms of, you know, and I will also say one other thing, which was that my experience, which is basically I have a feeling I think I'm probably sort of the same generation as your father who was turning you on to certain books as you were growing up. And I actually graduated college in 1969. And felt just as you said you did, that there was something clearly wrong. And rather than jumping into one of the tracks that was available, I farmed, I sailed, I lived at a yoga camp, I taught, I started an alternative high school, I worked in the McGovern campaign. It was, you know, doing things that were not the, necessarily the things that were expected. So I just wanted to let you know that we share some of the path as well as some of the perspective. One of the things that you say very early, I think, in Climate or New Story, or that certainly sits at the root of some of that, is this sense that societies can pass through initiations, and that that one of the things I think is crucial in your perspective is that the way we've been doing things is creating crises that might be big enough to cause us to find a new path. And I guess tell us how what you mean by initiation, and if that is in some sense what you mean by society's potential for initiation at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think initiation, a true initiation, is always accompanied by some kind of crisis, which is a situation where your customary way of doing things and your customary way of seeing yourself in the world just doesn't work. And so you are compelled to let go of how you've been seeing and doing things and to be open to something new. So I think the most significant aspect of our initiation as a collective right now is that it's the realization that we're not separate, that what we do to the world is inescapable, that it comes back to affect ourselves. The first part of the initiation was the advent of nuclear weapons, because that made the age-old solution to conflict no longer possible. The age-old solution was you completely obliterate your enemy,
yeah,
and you win a victory. And that became impossible. And for the last 80 years, 70, whatever, 70-some years, war between the great powers has been impossible. Like, it's mutually assured destruction. And to take that new data point in is really a profound shift that we have not completely digested yet. And then the second part of this curriculum of interbeing is the word I like to use. It's coined by Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm told. The second part of the curriculum is the environmental crisis, where we're learning that what we do to the world comes back to us. And climate change, the dominant narrative of climate change, is one way that that realization is being articulated. Now, as you know from reading the book, I don't agree 100% with the dominant narrative, but it has that core truth that we're not separate from the world, that we are intimate participants, and that we cannot escape the effect of our actions. I could say a bit more, just maybe a little bit more about what the effect is.
Let me ask one thing, which won't take you away from that, I don't think, but it sounds like, as with the... And it's interesting because as I asked the question, I was thinking, well, for my generation, this initial one was the threat of nuclear annihilation. And sure enough, you cite that as a previous initiation point. That it strikes me that as the worst of the crisis is moving toward us or is hovering over us and so on, that my assumption and my experience is that two things happen. One, people harden, and two, some, see a new way. And it seems to me that what happens in these moments and what's happening right now, and certainly what happened in the 60s, if you will, is that both of those things happen simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes happen simultaneously within one person.
Very good. Yes, yes. So where were you going to go with that?
Well, yeah, maybe if I can weave it into what you were saying, sometimes it's hard to recognize exactly how our actions are coming back to bite us. We tend to think that it's going to be like the dominant narrative is all these bad things are going to happen to us because of climate change. It'll be rising sea levels, economic losses, refugees, crop failures. And so the bad things are understood as things that we can measure according to our existing metrics of well-being. But I have a different fear, which is that just as it has been for centuries, we will continue to degrade and destroy the living world, and our lifespan, our GDP, our literacy rates, all the things that Steven Pinker talks about as proving that we live in a better world than ever, all of these things will continue to look fine. Yet at the same time, we will experience more and more depression, more and more addiction, more and more suicide, more and more feelings of alienation and meaninglessness. And that these actually are intimately connected to our relationship to the natural world, to the rest of life. Because as we become more and more disconnected, something of our core being atrophies, it withers. Because who we are not these separate individuals. We exist only in relationship and only through a full complement of relationships to people and to non-human beings, like soil, like trees, birds, water. Only through the fullness of these relationships do we experience ourselves as whole, as belonging in the world, as being at home in the universe. So you could look at a possible future of geoengineering and cities enclosed in bubbles, you know, and carbon-sucking machines and synthetic food or hydroponics factories and so on, and everybody gets fed and everything else dies and the world turns into one giant strip mine and waste dump. And from the metrics of well-being that we ordinarily use, that would be okay. But something in us dies every time a species goes extinct or every time a forest gets cut down, some core part of ourselves. And so this understanding that we are interconnected and interdependent and interexistent goes far beyond our ordinary way of, are we going to survive or not?
Mm-hmm. Let me
say,
yes, oh, very much so. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what you're saying is that if we view the world as a machine, and we look at metrics, which, as you point out, work with machines, you know, you can check mm-hmm. various numbers and you can find where the flaw is and you can put in a new part there or something like that and cure it, as it were. That doesn't work
right.
with organisms, and it doesn't work with ecosystems, and it doesn't work with planets. That we could, if we were excellent at that mechanical model, we could perhaps forestall the worst of climate change, forestall the worst of some of these things, and yet have a life that is not what life has been, and is not truly, sustaining versus sustainable. You could maybe make it mm-hmm. sustainable, but it wouldn't be sustaining to life. And I get that. Let me.
That's really well said. Can I just elaborate a tiny bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just that part of this world as machine mentality includes, okay, what's the cause of climate change? It's one factor, like greenhouse gases. And if you change the air-fuel mixture, then your diesel machine will work better.
Yeah.
And that kind of reductionism is so contrary to understanding of a living planet that it leaves out the contribution of I call them the organs and tissues of Gaia, that don't easily lend themselves to quantification. Like, what's the carbon contribution of beavers? What's their climate effect? Only when you understand how they slow down the water and increase filtration into the groundwater and then allow longer periods of transpiration of the trees that then bring in rain from the ocean and so on and so forth. Like, there's this whole, it's almost like a physiology that depends on water cycles that intimately involve life. Like, only when you understand that could you say, oh, so beavers actually do aid, you know, carbon sequestration or something. And it's that kind of ecological, physiological understanding that sometimes gets ignored when we focus on something that's easy to quantify.
Yeah, and I would You don't necessarily have to respond to this one, but I would say another thing going on there is that many of the methods and approaches that actually, in some sense, have worked had to do with the scientific revolution, and reductionism was an important part of that, and so on. But what happens, of course, as very, I think, clear to almost anyone now, is if you look at how problems are viewed, or even how problems are studied, and you look at the separate fields that we've divided our universities into, and the silos that we've divided our sciences into, the understanding of the contribution of beavers to planetary climate is no one's job. You know, it's like there are people who study beavers and there are people who study climate science, and they may never ever meet. And it takes a stepping back and a comprehensive a view of things to be able to see systems rather than all these different separate units. And I think that's another piece of what's gone on in this mechanical approach. By the way, it seems to me that, first of all, let me tell people that you're listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Charles Eisenstein, and he's author most recently of Climate, A New Story. And anyone who listens to this show knows that both climate and stories are common themes. And you can learn more about Charles's work. You can find books, essays, podcasts, and so on at charleseisenstein.org. And Eisenstein is the way you would expect it spelled, Eisenstein, charleseisenstein.org. It seems we can go from what you were saying last, we can go into two places. And I want to, within the next half hour, which is, or 25 minutes, which we basically have left, cover both of them. One, and I'm going to suggest we go to one first so we don't miss it. But one is, you have a bit of a contrarian approach to climate change and how we deal with it. And I want to make sure we talk about that. So I'm going to suggest that next. But that other piece, the difference between the way Steven Pinker or Nick Kristof, both of whom I've interviewed over the years, and I will tell you, Pinker I interviewed within the last month about the book that you, in an essay you wrote, were responding to. I definitely want to talk about that. But let's go first to your as I said, it's sort of a contrarian approach to climate change, climate science, responses to climate change, etc.
Yeah. I guess what maybe one thing you're thinking about is my critique of carbon reductionism that I just touched on a little bit. And I'm not, so, you know, one thing that I've, that applies actually more generally, not just to the climate issue, is that in any polarized debate, and our society has been pretty much overtaken by polarized debates now, in any polarized debate, the key to resolving it lies in the things that neither side is talking about, or the things that both sides unconsciously agree on. And so those are the things that I'm unearthing in this book.
So what you're saying is we've become more polarized. Anybody knows that. And you actually write and talk about what that means, and it means, you know, that every issue has a good and a bad, and that every conversation sort of has a convince or not, and so on. But that thing that you just said, you believe that the approach to get beyond that is to find what both sides share, but unreel that one again.
What are the unconscious agreements? And what are the questions that are not being asked? So, for example, if you look at immigration, you know, one side says, build a wall, keep them out, protect our jobs. The other side says, let them in, we have to be compassionate. America was built on immigration. Okay, neither side is asking what conditions in Guatemala or Nicaragua are so horrible that people are desperate, so desperate that they'll leave their families behind, they'll risk their children's lives to move to an entirely new place. and what brings about those conditions. No one's talking about that. I mean, not no one, but
yeah.
not, only on the fringes.
Right.
You know, because you get into imperialism, you get into neoliberal capitalism, you get into things that you don't know what to do about it, and they involve yourself, and it's uncomfortable. So that would be an example of questions that are not asked.
And let me put another perspective on that, which is, you say it's the things that they both unconsciously agree on. It also, at least in that example, and I think in a lot of examples, it ends up being upstream of where we find ourselves.
Right.
To use a natural metaphor, but I think one that's really apt, is that as we get to downstream problems, this is true in nature and in society, things become much more complex and much more difficult. Upstream, had we seen something and dealt with something, perhaps it could have been healed more easily. And I think that's what you're saying, is that some of the conditions that end up, suddenly we're looking at the American border, but upstream of that American border is a lot of other things, history, forces, et cetera, that had we dealt with them, this situation at the border might not even exist.
That's right. Yeah, so in climate change, you know, one of the assumptions that is dominant in the mainstream, both people who are alarmed about climate change and people who are skeptical of it, is that this is, if it exists, if it is a problem, it's the biggest problem that we face. So the skeptics and the alarmists both agree that this is the biggest environmental issue, and if you care about the environment, this is what you care about. And because what I found, you know, I read quite a number of websites on both sides of the issue, and what makes the skeptical ones deniers isn't that they question the science of greenhouse gas-induced global warming. It's that they have an unstated anti-environmental agenda, almost universally, that finds some reason to dismiss or minimize any environmental concern. Basically, they're like, everything's fine. So basically, they're kind of happy with the reduction of environmentalism to climate, because it basically takes a million issues and makes them into one issue. And then they say, and this one issue, this is bogus.
Uh-huh.
So we don't
right.
have to worry about the environment.
Right. In other words, if we can win, even if temporarily, on the degree of climate change threat or the timing of climate change threat and so on, if we can win on that one, we've won and everything's fine.
Right.
And what you're saying is what gets left
right.
out there is the degradation and the destruction that's happening forest by forest, river by river, village by village mm-hmm. around the world, right? And no one ends up, I mean, environmentalism used to actually be about what was happening in the local lake, the local
yeah.
river. And now if it gets reduced and all collected under climate change, there's a lot that gets lost.
Right. So I was just reading about seismic surveys of the continental shelves, where basically they're looking for geological formations that have oil and gas. So they send these ships, these survey ships that blast these basically air guns, these 165 decibel blasts for you know sonar surveys every 10 seconds, 24 hours a day for weeks and months at a time. And imagine you're a whale. Like these are deafening, the whales. They stop singing their songs. They get brain hemorrhages. They damage like all kinds of marine life. They cause plankton death. Like all of these things become subsumed. Like why do you oppose this? If you say, well, because the seismic surveys are going to allow oil and gas exploration and that'll create greenhouse gases and intensify climate change. Like if you make it about that, then you're no longer making it about those poor whales, those poor fish, those seals, the plankton, the ecosystem, a living being that is getting damaged and dying. And you don't have to actually buy into greenhouse gas-induced global warming to want to protect the whales. So I see a danger, like a rhetorical and strategic danger, in hitching environmentalism to the climate engine. And it's like, it kind of, and I've talked to many, you know, environmentalists in the field who are like, yeah, like I talked to one a few days ago. He's like, yeah, like the funders now are only funding it if it's relevant to climate change.
Wow. They're
sucking the air out of the room.
Yeah.
For other issues. And I realized, you know, in writing this book that even if I decided, okay, I agree with the skeptics and global warming is not, you know, as scientifically sound as people are saying, even if I agreed with them, I would still be opposed to fracking. I'd still be opposed to the tar sands excavation. I'd still be opposed to offshore oil drilling. I'd still be opposed to strip mines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, so there's actually, I don't need that climate narrative in order to do everything that the climate activists want to do anyway, except by the carbon narrative, then, you know, pretty soon you end up supporting biofuels plantations that are converting enormous tracts of land in Africa and South America into monocrop tree farms and sugarcane farms and jatropha plantations. And you end up like being, you know, proposing geoengineering schemes and like a lot of dangerous ideas are coming from carbon reductionism. And that's why I'm advocating so strongly for a living Earth paradigm that would actually reduce carbon emissions as a side effect of holding every place and being as precious and sacred.
Yeah, let me just say, you say that the real threat to the biosphere is actually worse than most people, even on the left, understand, and that it transcends climate, and we can only meet it through a multidimensional, multi-local healing response. You suggest a different order of priorities than the one that the normal climate conversation. Could you lay those out? And as you say, it turns out, of course, you do these priorities, and you'll be dealing with climate, but not by the normal way. So that your priorities would be.
Yeah, thank you for that. The priorities come from the living planet physiological view of Earth. So first priority is to protect any remaining pristine ecosystems, especially the Amazon. That is overridingly important. That's where the planet's memory of health still resides. And if we can protect those, there's always hope. That's the deep memory of Gaia, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Second priority, so first conservation, protection. Second priority is regeneration, to heal the damage that's been done, reforestation and regenerative agriculture. And there are people out there doing miracles of healing on land, restoring soil, species thought extinct come back, springs that have been dry for 30 years start flowing again. It's incredible what humans can do when they turn their attention towards service and healing. So that's second priority. Third priority is to stop poisoning the planet by dousing it with toxic chemicals all the time. Insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, pharmaceutical waste, toxic industrial waste, radioactive waste, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because that damages the planet on the tissue level. And then fourth priority in this view is to cut greenhouse gases, which put more stress on a physiology, on an organ system that's already severely weakened.
That's right. One of the things you point to many times is that the effects of greenhouse gases are more extreme because of the weakened physiology of forest, water systems, species, etc. And that if those systems was robust, they'd be dealing with the climate, the greenhouse gas shifts differently. But two things I want to point out in what you just laid out in those priorities. One is and these are things you have pointed out in your writing, because I've read them, is that when you regenerate soil, regenerate an area, you get evidence, tangible evidence quickly. One of the things about climate change is that the threat is, while we know about droughts, fires, intense storms, and so on, the threat of the real crisis seems to be in the future. And so you make a change, and it probably, you may do the right thing greenhouse gas wise and not see the effect. It might just be that the fires don't get worse, which is hard for people to see.
Right.
Whereas when you do what you're talking about, which is repair things, heal things, the effects are there quickly, and people can see them.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is another point is that you're talking about poisoning the world, pesticides, herbicides, pollution, etc. That is also human health, you know, things that people can see and feel and have the positive effects of very quickly when you approach them that way. And as you say, doing those things will, by the very nature of what it takes to do them and what the effects of doing them are, will be a way of dealing mm-hmm. with climate change.
Yeah.
And what happens, what sort of responses do you get? In other words, when you voice this, and you're not in someone who just, you know, loves Gaia and is all, yes, yes, keep going, Charles. Do you get, what happens when, I mean, are there some negative, what sort of negative responses do you get with your approach?
Oh, well, yeah, there's maybe two different kinds of negative responses. Or three. One is that people who are very strongly wedded to the carbon-centric narrative say, hey, you know, you're even if what you're saying is true, like you're giving aid and comfort to the denialists, to the deniers, and you're not helping our narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And you're ignoring the science, which isn't actually true. You know, I've read a lot of the science, but part of my point is, and just like you were saying, like when you do earth repair, regeneration, you see the effects. You don't have to take the authority of the scientific establishment for granted. You don't have to accept that. And a lot of the dominant narrative today is basically trust science, trust what teacher says, trust the authorities that science is embedded in. And today, a lot of people, for good reason, are becoming very suspicious of what authority is telling them about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really dangerous ground to tread on. A friend was just talking about his Trump-supporting brother, who is a rancher and is practicing holistic grazing and like building soil at half an inch a year. And he doesn't believe in climate change. Yet he's sequestering more carbon than... Yeah, you know, 1,000 environmentalists put together. Like, he's doing more for the environment, but for totally other reasons.
Right. I'd like to shift. We've got about 8 minutes left. I'd like to shift to this other question, which is, there was an article that you wrote, Our New Happy Life was the essay, The Ideology of Development, an essay you wrote in May of 2018. And I'm just going to read a couple of things you wrote just to nail it to begin with. Two recent articles, one by Nick Kristof in the New York Times and the other by Steven Pinker in the Wall Street Journal. But Steven Pinker's is very much that article is kind of a summation of his book, Enlightenment Now, which basically says the world has never been in better shape, or human society has never been in better shape based on the shifts that occurred with the Enlightenment, science, reason, et cetera, et cetera. And they both, I'm going back to your quote, they both of which asserted with ample statistics that the overall state of humanity is better now than at any time in history. Fewer people die in wars, car crashes, airplane crashes, even from gun violence. Poverty rates are lower than ever recorded. Life expectancy is higher. More people than ever are literate, have access to electricity and running water, and live in democracies. and that these articles, again, I'm quoting you, affirm and celebrate the basic direction of society thanks to reason, science, and enlightened Western political thinking. We are making strides toward a better world. You say, I share their optimism that humanity is walking a positive evolutionary path, but for this evolution to proceed, it is necessary that we acknowledge and integrate the suffering and the loss that their narrative skips over. Expand on that.
Yeah, it lies in the things that their metrics do not include. Are people really happier and better off because they are more literate or because they have higher GDP per capita? If you look at other measures, such as, you know, opioid addiction or suicide, or the fact that 1 in 5 women in the United States is on antidepressants, obesity. You know, it's becomes a little bit more questionable whether we're actually happier and better off. And then there are the things that you can't even begin to measure. So by focusing on these metrics, like these metrics come from a certain worldview about where happiness comes from. It comes from the meeting of your basic needs, and it's part of the ideology that we are motivated to maximize reproductive self-interest or economic self-interest. So the more of that you have, the better off you are. But what about the well-being that comes from connection to other people, to community? So today we have higher GDP than a generation ago, but if something happens to you, you don't have a network of support around to help you, and you're cast into destitution. You don't have community that's taking care of you without the use of money. But if you go back 10 generations, say, and you lived in a small village somewhere, like, you hardly even used money. Yeah, and today there are still people, you know, in remote villages in India or Bangladesh or tribes in the Amazon, that they make less than $1 a day. But they live so much better than anybody you'll meet in this society. And the levels of, I don't know if you've been to some of these places, but many people who go, they're like, I've never seen such happy people.
Right.
I've never seen so much joy. And if your house burns down, your neighbors come and help you rebuild it. If you fall sick, people come and take care of you. And so these social relationships have been replaced by monetized relationships in a process called economic growth. And intimate local connections have been placed by abstract, distant global connections mediated by money. But that doesn't mean that we're better off.
Right. Let me share a couple of my responses. One is that I must tell you, when I was a freshman in college and I took a survey course in social relations, the moment that sticks out for me more than anything, and it might be more than almost anything I ever saw in a college classroom, was when I saw a film in 1965 of Kalahari Bushmen, hunter-gatherers, and it was about that they were happier without progress. And this was a formative moment in my life, and it just blew my mind. It had never occurred to me, you know, growing up and reading what I'd read and seeing what I saw and having the conversation I'd had, that was possible. Another thing was Bill McKibben, who is now, you know, one of the leaders of 350.org, you know, a great leader in the climate side, wrote a book called Deep Economy, which you may know. Mm-hmm. And in it, he makes the point that there's an annual measurement of happiness that has been taking place in the U.S. for some time, and that peak happiness scores were 1958. And he contends that any gains in technology and convenience have been outweighed by loss of community. And another piece in what you're saying is that what Pinker's and Kristof's analysis is based on is numbers, and always macro numbers. And so you both have what can't be measured, what isn't measured, and what individual personal experiences are left out of large numbers.
Right. And another question is, what biases are encoded in the things you choose to measure? What value judgments about what's important in life?
Yep. let's go back to that where we started off the conversation. You got about a minute. Go back to that initiation, that crisis we're passing through, and the what gives you hope.
Mm-hmm. So when we understand that the cause of climate change is everything, and that the health of this earth depends on the health of all of its organs, and that human beings are among these organs, then we understand that any healing work, whether it's on a social level, racial, individual, psychological, community, or ecological, any healing work is going to be healing for all things. And that's intuitive when we understand that we're not separate, mm-hmm. that we're moving into full participation in the tribe of all life on Earth. Nothing less than that big a shift of perspective and beingness is going to fulfill the initiation that we're going through.
Charles Eisenstein's latest book is Climate, A New Story, and you can learn more at charleseisenstein.org. And Eisenstein is E-I-S-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. Climate, A New Story, charleseisenstein.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. A World That Just Might Work, one word, Terrence McNally, one word, TerrenceMcNally. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of guests and issues, plus eight or so articles I choose each week to flesh out the conversation, adding examples and context, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams, Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. And please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Charles Eisenstein, and keep up your good work.
Yes, thank you.
Hello, I'm Casey Hobbs.
And I'm Shane Mason, and we're the hosts of Nurse Talk Radio.
Here's what we're talking about this week. That music can mean only one thing. It's time for Healthcare in America with senior correspondent Donna Smith. Donna, welcome.
Thank you, Casey. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, so now, Donna, I don't know which is worse, having the knee and having surgery, or Trump's 10-year budget unveiled Monday calls for more than $845 billion in reductions to Medicare.
It just is so mind-boggling. Let's talk about how big that number is. $845 billion is getting real close to $1 trillion. So you end up cutting that much money from the Medicare budget. Don't tell us that's all waste, fraud, and abuse, because it's not. And we know what will happen with patients in that process, and with nurses too, is as the providers have cuts to what they're getting in terms of reimbursement, they're not going to want to serve Medicare patients as much as they have in the past.
Which is designed to do. I'm sorry, but it's just interesting to me that he's pushing this forward at a time where 70% of Americans want Medicare for all.
Yep.
And we're supposed to think those two aren't connected. Yeah, it's outrageous. So they also say that these cuts are bipartisan. Come on, is that true?
Right, right. That is not true. And the Democrats have long called for appropriate kinds of monitoring of what people do with Medicare. And the reality for most Americans is that if you go to your provider and you go to your hospital, those people are not defrauding you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more information about these topics at nursetalksite.com or nationalnursesunited.org.
This podcast is powered by National Nurses United, the nation's largest union for registered nurses.